From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. This hour, some of our favorite conversations about work and finding deeper meaning in it. From L. Simone Scott of America's Test Kitchen.
If I have to do something for the next 25 years of my life, it better be something I love. And the only thing that I could think of was cooking. It was the one thing that brought me like peace and joy, serenity, family time, healing.
And New England Conservatory President Emeritus Lawrence Lesser.
I love working with young people, and the goal is what I call communication. And we all feel it, and we support one another.
To former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin.
I'd just like to be known as a good human being, somebody who cared about the state, loved the state, and tried to improve the lives of the people who live in it.
Plus, the Needham brothers behind Life is Good. Next on a Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And welcome to a special Labor Day edition of the show. Through the years on Radio Boston, we've talked a lot about work and working. We've taken calls on Americans' addiction to working. We've talked about the future of work, robots and artificial intelligence, the idea of a universal basic income, and the future of union organizing. We've spoken with restaurant owners, writers, carpenters, academics, musicians, politicians, entrepreneurs, artists, and regular people about what they do every day, their unique crafts. All people who wake up every morning and try to do their very best for themselves and their families. People who want to feel fulfilled in the good that they're doing in the world. So on this Labor Day edition of Radio Boston, we will revisit some of our favorite conversations about work and finding meaning in that work. One of those conversations is with New England Conservatory cellist Lawrence Lesser. We're playing his music throughout the hour. We'll hear from him later in the show. But let's start today with L. Simone Scott. When she joined us in January, it was with a pretty extraordinary premise. She wants to be the Oprah of the culinary world, and it turns out she's well on her way. She's the first African-American woman to be featured on PBS's America's Test Kitchen, making her one of the most visible black women on food TV. She finds deep meaning in being an inspiration to millions of women of color watching. But her career has not been without obstacles. Scott came to cooking at the age of 28, after she lost her job, then her home, then her car, right in the middle of the recession. L. Simone Scott spoke with WBUR's Maria Garcia, and they began with how she came to the culinary industry out of sheer necessity and out of love.
The thought occurred to me, if I have to do something for the next 25 years of my life, it better be something I love. And the only thing that I could think of at that moment was cooking. It was the one thing that brought me like peace and joy, serenity, family time, healing. It just made sense.
Yeah. So what challenges did you face or see other women of color facing when coming up in the culinary industry?
Well, I think initially, like most people who decide to change careers later in life, you become financially challenged. You know, you essentially become a college student all over again. Even if you're 28, you're 18 one more time. And of course, that's a challenge, you know, to start over. That was the first challenge. I think that coming into the industry and just not seeing a lot of women and not seeing a lot of women of color, it makes you question not only your belongingness, but like your ability, you know, like, do I belong? You know, should I be here?
So I want to ask you about She Chef. You know, it's this leadership and mentorship program you founded for female culinary professionals, specifically women of color. And if I'm not mistaken, it's literally the only organization that's solely committed to women of color in the food, beverage, and hospitality world. What do you think are the biggest needs for women of color in the industry?
I think some of the larger needs for women in the industry are basically business support. Women in general are less likely to get funding for businesses. And I think that when you are finding yourself in a disproportionate place in business, you need someone to tell you that you can do it. You need examples of people who are actually doing it. And you need someone who's willing to share the resources, you know. And we all know resources can be very expensive. If you have access and can afford those things, it might be a lot easier for you. But if you don't come from that space in life, then you need to know that you can do it. And She Chef is a platform for women who are doing it to share with those who aspire. And they're really giving from their heart. Most of the time, they're not getting paid a large amount of money to do it. So they're really giving from the heart.
Yeah, I like how you put it in an interview you did with The Root, an online magazine on African-American issues. You said, when something new or different is happening, it's always met with resistance.
Yes.
I always knew that it was my personal mission to end these cycles by breaking down these barriers. I later learned that, like any building, there's ways to get in other than the front door. Elaborate on that for me.
Well, you know, I feel you hear the old adage, if you are not given a seat at the table, bring a chair. It's similar to that. You know, there is more than one way to reach a level of success. And also, there are many definitions of what success is, you know. And so in She Chef, we help people to figure out what is success for them, not the measure of what their families think or what society thinks or what they see on television. What is your personal level and measure of success? And I feel like once you define that for yourself, it really changes how you go about, you know, meeting your personal needs and meeting your personal goals. You know, if you can narrow down what it means to you to be successful, then you've already cleared the path for yourself to reach your certain levels. Also, though, it is very helpful to have someone who can go before you and kind of experience those obstacles and clear the path for you. And I've always felt that that was my calling in life.
On Radio Boston last year, we spoke with a local chef and restaurateur, Tiffany Faison. Tiger Mama and Sweet Cheeks Q, among a few of the restaurants she owns in Fenway. And this was after many male chefs had been accused of misconduct in the kitchen. So we asked her how she thinks the industry needs to build a culture of respect and fairness in kitchens. And let's listen to what she said.
Sure.
We have to look out for each other. We have to speak well of each other. We have to support the people that are doing it well and have hard conversations with the people that aren't. You know, it's hard because I was having a conversation with a very well-known woman in the industry that's also on television. She said, I don't care when I walk into a restaurant how the chef is treating his staff. I care what's on the plate. That can't be any longer.
Do you think that that change has happened or is happening? How do you see the Me Too movement affecting the industry?
I think that, albeit a slow change, I think it is happening. I feel that the Me Too movement has required people to have more accountability for their personal behavior, their business practices. It's definitely put it under a microscope. And no one wants to be on the wrong end of, you know, humanism. Like, you don't want to be the one known as the person who's treating your staff horribly. It just doesn't fit the culture right now, you know? And so, I mean, outside of wanting to fit into what's working well, I think people are realizing that creating positive kitchen cultures, which is also a huge part of my mission, I think they're realizing that creating these positive kitchen cultures not only looks good on paper, obviously, but it actually just fosters a better workspace.
And creativity.
Absolutely.
Right. Innovation. So let's talk about what's brought you to Boston, your role on America's Test Kitchen, which has made you, as we mentioned earlier, one of the most visible Black women on food television, woman. How do you think about your role on the show and how large of a platform that you have now?
I think that my role on the show is just as important as every other contributor to this show. I think we all have a responsibility on America's Test Kitchen to teach Americans and our outstretched community just good ways to cook. You know, we're not looking to modernize Indian cuisine or, you know, we're just looking to show people how to make good food techniques, right? So I feel like we all have a shared responsibility in that. Now, as far as being the first African-American woman on the show, I mean, obviously, that's a pretty huge responsibility. You know, I'm not only representing my family and myself, of course, I'm representing all the women of color. They might not accept my representation, but I am moving in that. I am representing them. And it's been, I think it's been very impactful. You know, it's done a lot for me. I've learned so much working at America's Test Kitchen. I've learned so much about myself being on television. I never wanted to be on television. That's the big secret.
This is the first time on television.
Yes,
right?
It literally fell in my lap. I mean, I was a producer in the past, and it was relative, but being on camera is a whole different beast.
Yeah, well, one, I was going to tell you about that. You know, one thing I really enjoy is watching you on the show and how you very much are yourself. I mean, I think your sense of humor comes through in these really subtle ways. You know, when you're doing demonstrations on the show, for instance, we have this clip when you're showing host Bridget Lancaster how to make a French butter cake.
Yes.
I want to play that clip.
Okay.
Bridget, this cake looks amazing. Look what we did.
I feel like I've been waiting 1,000 years for this cake. I know how good it is, but it never gets old.
Let's find out right now. I would say you can share this with your friends, but we probably won't.
When you first moved to Boston to be a part of the show, you found out that you had been diagnosed with stage 1C ovarian cancer.
Yes.
So I can't imagine how hard that must have been to battle cancer right after moving to a new city and a new job and facing these new challenges.
Yeah, that was honestly the most difficult thing I've had to do to date. Mm. Like, if anyone asked me, it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Dealing with fighting and trying to adjust to a new city all while, you know, experiencing cancer. Wow. It was surreal. Like, I look back on it now. I look at pictures of myself because I keep all of my photos. I can't believe, I don't even know where I mustered up the strength to do it. But I tell you this, having cancer or just having a terminal disease in general really makes you think about your life and what you want to do and how you want to live it for whatever time you have left. And I'm a faith-based person. I do everything off of faith. I believe in a higher power. I trust the universe and I move in that way. But I promised the creator that if I survived cancer, I would utilize the rest of my life to make a change and be impactful, not only in cancer, women's cancer awareness, but also, you know, just for my life's work. I will not waste any more time. And I go full speed ahead. I can be in Mexico on Friday and Monday. I'll be back at the office and people will be like, weren't you just in another country? Like, yeah, we got work to do. You know, I've been down. I've been sick. I've been bedridden and not been able to move and get about. So now that I can, you can't stop me. When I'll stop? When you see me on TV in Oprah's kitchen, that's when I'll stop.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. So let's talk about your favorite hashtag, which is included on many of your Instagram posts. Hashtag culinary Oprah.
Yes.
Is it a goal? Is it a mentality?
It's a little bit of both. I want to be out here talking to all the women chefs and, of course, the women chefs of color, talking about their lives and their accomplishments. But I also want to be sitting pretty high like Oprah. She is like the most.
She's just the most.
She's the most.
She's the most.
Period.
Yeah. Oprah's just the goat of the world.
She's a goat of the world. So true.
Yeah, greatest of all time.
WBUR's Maria Garcia speaking with America's Test Kitchen's L. Simone Scott. Stay with us. After a short break, we'll hear from two powerhouses in their own fields, folks who love their work so much, they've continued it into their 80s. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you're enjoying your Labor Day. Here at Radio Boston, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations on work and finding meaning in that work. This is a recording of cellist Lawrence Lesser performing a Sergei Rachmaninoff sonata for cello and piano. And you can really hear his signature sound here. Lesser has had a long, illustrious career working for the last 46 years at the New England Conservatory, serving as its president from 1983 to 1996. He studied under renowned cellist Gregor Piatigorsky and played under composer Igor Stravinsky. In 1966, he was a top prize winner in the Tchaikovsky competition. Lesser has performed as a soloist with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, London Philharmonic, Los Angeles Philharmonic, and many more. We spoke with Lawrence Lesser in September of last year, right before a big milestone, his 80th birthday. We began with what keeps Lesser going, what keeps him at NEC, and the meaning he finds in inspiring the next generation of musicians.
Oh, I love being there. I mean, I love working with young people, and the conservatory is a place that is so supportive of them and of all of us who teach and work there. It's a fantastic community. of artists and people supporting the arts. And artists are those of us further along, and the young people, they're like our young artists. It's just a great place to be.
You talk a lot about young people and your passion for them and working with them. How do you foster that community and that collegiality in the young people with whom you work?
I think you have to show that you love what you're doing, that you respect them for what they are trying to do, and you try to remember what it was like when you were that age. And when you find support in that community, everybody understands that nobody is the top dog. Everybody is trying for the same goal. And the goal is what I call communication.
Mm-hmm.
And we all feel it, and we support one another. We help one another. When I was a kid, you'd said, I'm right behind you, or I'm supporting you. No, everybody says, I got your back. I would say that pretty nearly at NEC, it's quite a beautiful image. Everybody has everybody else's back.
You know, I was just listening to you, and I'm so curious. You said a second ago that you try to remember what it was like back when it was you. What was it like back when it was you? What do you remember and cherish from when you were in their shoes?
Well, I think I was a very lucky guy. I grew up in Los Angeles, where there was an exceptional musical community, and that was a product of bad things in Europe, Hitler and all of that, and the fact that there was a motion picture industry there, which attracted a lot of musicians to play in orchestra music for film. And that's where I had a chance to do that later. But a lot of people came there, like great artists like Igor Stravinsky and Arnold Schoenberg, Yasha Heifetz, Rubinstein, my teacher, Pieter Gorski, Thomas Mann, the great author, Joseph Sigeti, the great violinist. They came to the Los Angeles area both because they found one another and because it was a warm climate and it was about as far away as they could get and forget about what they'd run away from.
Yeah, now you went on actually to become the president of NEC, a role you occupied from 1983 to 1996, so more than a decade. While you were the president, you oversaw the restoration of Jordan Hall, and you also implemented the first Monday at Jordan Hall concert series, which you still program, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So what was your vision for that concert series, and how has it evolved?
Jordan Hall is one of the greatest spaces for live music in the world, not just in this country. It's the envy of everybody who has a chance to play it. They just want to be there. And among our faculty, what we do is we not only teach, but we play, we sing, we compose, whatever those things. And when I came to NEC in 1974, in those years before I became president, there were regularly faculty chamber music concerts that were kind of ad hoc. Oh, let's get together and play a program of music of Brahms or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And after I became president in 1983, I said, well, maybe we could make something a little bit more structural about that. And so we ended up choosing a pattern of where it was the first Monday of six calendar months. And that's where it is now, October, November, December, March, April, May.
Yep.
Sometimes people catch me in January and say, what's the first Monday this month? I said, no, this is the month when you go out and shovel snow. So, but
no playing till you're done shoveling.
Something like that. So I like to say that I am really am the curator of the series and not the artistic director. I guess my title is artistic director because everybody comes to me with ideas, and it's just my job to try and weave something together out of those.
That's
wonderful. And it's always changing. It's always morphing into something else a little bit different.
All right. Now, your fans and music fans will go crazy if we don't get to some music here while I've got you. So I want us to start with a piece by Johann Sebastian Bach that I know I've learned means a lot to you. It's one of his six suites for cello. This is you playing. This is suite number 3 in C major. Let's take a minute and let our listeners listen. And you have said that this is a piece you're never done with. What does that mean, and why do you love Bach?
The music is, like my teacher, Pieter Gorski, used to say, it's better than we are. No matter how long you play it, how long you hear it, you never stop finding more things about it. The music is so eternal, so amazingly put together. And so you do it, and then, I mean, what you played a minute ago or is from recordings I made a few years ago, all six of the Bach suites in Jordan Hall, by the way. And I listen to them, I say, oh, I could have done that better, or why didn't I do this? And that kind of music brings that kind of reaction.
Do you think you'll keep playing those suites for as long as you play?
I'm sure I will.
You know, you have mentioned several times in our conversation your mentor, Gregor Piatigorsky. I'd like our audience to understand, those who may not be as familiar with him, he seems to have been a profound mentor not only for players of cello in general, but for you. Tell us a little bit about him and what struck you most about him as a student. What kind of impact did he have on you as a musician?
Well, I think he was a profoundly deep artist and who was a great virtuoso. He was a complete package. And coupled with that was a man who was physically large. He was about 6'4", and his heart was big. And he cared a lot about young people, and he cared a lot about values of beauty and everything in life. So the impact that he had on those of us who were fortunate enough to be around him was to develop an attitude, not simply about music, but about values in life. So he was a very philosophical man and a very funny man. I mean, just to say one really quick one, I mean, you struggle when you're playing, you learn how to play the notes, you need technique. But he put it a different way. He says, when the piece is difficult technically, it's the time to become very musical. And it seems just right.
So how do you help your students carry forward those same values? How do you help them move from technical to musical?
I make them sing. I make them listen to their own voice. Every artist is different from every other artist. And I don't want to train people who sound like me. Mm-hmm. I want to train them to learn how to sound like themselves. And that's very much what he did. I think that we have no way of knowing where they will go, what that will lead to. All we can do is to try and give them tools so that they can make that journey on their own. And that's what he did. That's what I try to do.
Yeah, you know, your music has brought you all over the world as a result of his mentorship and your own development. You've played with orchestras in London, in Tokyo, Russia, Italy, and you travel to teach and work with students. I understand you spent some time in Warsaw, and we have a piece you performed there by Polish composer Chopin. So let's hear that for a second.
Okay.
Now tell me about this piece, and what did you take away from the international teaching experiences like the one you had this summer?
Well, first of all, I had never been in Warsaw before, and everything in Warsaw is about Chopin. Mm. The name of the airport is Chopin.
Oh,
the school where we were teaching was Chopin. And when I played this recording that you're playing, I was sitting on a stage. On the back top of it was a bust of Chopin with a spotlight. He was looking over my shoulder the whole time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you smell the air, you eat the food, or whatever it is. It's different everywhere. And that was a very, very moving thing for me to do.
So we understand that you're going to be performing a piece which is called Shalomo, and it's by Ernest Bloch. You could have picked a lot of different music for this moment in time. Why did you pick this piece?
Well, I'm Jewish, and I'm a cellist, and this is a Jewish cellist's piece.
Oh, yeah.
And it's for cello and orchestra, and it is such deep, profound utterance about values that I hold so dear to myself. And I'm very, very thrilled to have a chance to play it.
Lawrence Lesser. Back in September of last year, he's a cellist, educator, and president emeritus of the New England Conservatory. Let's turn to another figure, also in their 80s, who has dedicated her life to her work, public service. Madeline May Kunin has been on the front lines of important issues for decades: women's rights, foreign policy, health care. Now 85, she's still going strong.
and out with a memoir, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Kunin fled Nazi Europe for America and has had an incredible career. Government of Vermont, ambassador to Switzerland, deputy secretary of education, author, feminist, mother, wife, immigrant. She spoke with Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna about how it feels to add former to some of those titles.
Well, the former is still present in my experience, you know, in creating the person I am today. It has shaped me, so I still consider myself to be a feminist, to be have the experience of having been a governor and ambassador. And now I have a new title, which I enjoy, and that is author and poet. And being a former whatever gives you a certain freedom. When you're in public life, you have to be more careful. So with my book, Coming of Age, I felt almost liberated at the age of 85. And I enjoy my new title just as much as I did the old ones.
Well, you mentioned your book. It's Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. And I'm struck by that subtitle, to the 80s. That journey isn't over. As you said, you're 85 now. You're well into your 80s.
Right. In the book, I tried to describe how it feels to be in the 80s, how as an old person, I'm tempted to say older, but I really should say old, we still shy away from that kind of language. I have some distance from my life's experience, and I feel I can be more forthright. I don't have to be so cautious.
It also seems like you're coming face to face with your reality. I mean, there's a picture of you right on the cover, and there you are in your full glory. And in the first sentences of your book, you say, "Death's black raven perches on my shoulder from time to time. Even when he flies away, I know he is in the neighborhood." That's not something you see in a book every day.
I guess not. I mean, you can't help but think about death. You can't let it dominate your thoughts, otherwise you don't have any fun anymore. But when you're 85, you don't think in 5-year terms or 10-year terms, what will you do then? You think in ones or twos or threes. And you know, my husband and I talked about carpe diem, live for the moment, live for the day. And that's what we have to do.
So, Governor, you mentioned your husband, John, and he died last year, and I'm sorry for your loss. He's a very integral part of this story. It's very much a love story in your book, and I guess I'm wondering in the year since his death, how you've handled his loss.
Well, in a way, it seems more real now than it did a year ago. I think that's true for a lot of people who lose a loved one. You sort of think more about the things you did together and the things you can't do anymore. The thing I miss most, I guess, is showing him my writing. He always read everything, and he read most of this book. So it's still a loss, but you can cope with it. I don't want to sit in a rocking chair and just watch the world go by. I still want to be involved as much as I can.
I'm wondering how you think we've gotten it wrong in regards to how we think about and treat aging Americans, and maybe if you have a message to younger people.
Well, I think we see the aged as a problem that's going to break the bank financially to support the elderly. And sometimes the aging or the elderly are simply ignored. I think particularly as women, we're aware of that. People just don't see us. People just dismiss the aging as not being interesting. I think just treat the elderly like people, like you would anybody else, and ask them questions and share your own thoughts, because we're very curious about young people. So just to keep connected with life, if possible, just lead as healthy and basic a life as you can and stay in touch.
That's beautiful. You make this very clear in your book that there's a double standard when it comes to men and women in terms of aging. How have you seen that in your career?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I think as the first woman in any menu, you're watched. you know, can you do this? Can you do the job as it's been held by men forever? And so when I was elected governor, I think I was scrutinized in a way that another man would not have been. You have to be more conscious of things that are small, like how you dress. And, of course, we're seeing this in the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. The whole question of likability has come out in the news. Women have to be both feminine and masculine. Masculine enough to hold the job like it's always been carried out, tough enough to be commander-in-chief, but then also warm and cuddly and likable. And, of course, Hillary was the key character of that dilemma. She was taken apart no matter what she did. It couldn't be quite right. But the exciting news is the women are still saying, I'm going to get out there and do it. I'm not going to be scared off and pushed off the podium just because I'm female. So hopefully we get to a point where we say, I'm going to judge this candidate for what she stands for, not whether she wears a red jacket or a white jacket.
Well, I'm glad you brought up women in politics because I was reminded so starkly by your positions during that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Clarence Thomas in 1991, because you sat there with a panel of other female activists and you said this to the panel of male senators before you.
Once again, when it comes to our issues, we find ourselves repeating the ancient cycle of helplessness that women have experienced throughout history. The sense of powerlessness is painful. It is apparent right here in this room, where women are not equally represented in the decision-making process of this country. We are put in the position of pleaders, asking you to ask our questions for us, to be our stand-ins, to intercede on our behalf.
And now here we are in 2019, almost three decades after you said that. And the House is the most heavily female in history, and there are 25 female U.S. senators. Are you hopeful for the next election cycle?
I have to be hopeful, but, you know, when you play that clip, I really did feel anger. Anger that we were the pleaders, we were the outsiders, we had to ask them for the favor of listening to our cause. And yes, I am hopeful, but the question is, who is on the committees that make the decisions? We need more than just partial representation. We need to get to half and half, 50% women.
So I know it's the early days of the 2020 race, but at least as of now, former Vice President Joe Biden is leading in many of the polls, and I'm just wondering what you make of that.
Well, I'm glad he's changed. I'm glad that he sees the errors of his earlier days. The worst part of that hearing in that period was that they didn't believe the accusations.
And you mean, of course, Anita Hill and the hearing of Clarence Thomas.
Yes, and she was almost made fun of, and that was just outrageous.
And, of course, Biden has been reconciling with some of his past behavior and perhaps his inappropriate touching of women. And in your book, you write about your own experiences with comments and kissing and the way men treated you through the years. In a sort of post-Me Too era, are you encouraged by these societal changes on this front?
Yes. I mean, we're saying things out loud that we didn't say out loud before. If we did, we confided to a friend. We would have sort of this secret life where we could confide in one another. It's now out there in the public arena. So some people say, well, maybe it's not fair to men. Maybe we're accusing them unfairly. But I think what we've really created is a forum for discussion about sexual harassment and the consequences. So it's a bright day.
And Governor Cunin, you also served in the Clinton administration, and I'm also just wondering if you think differently about his behavior with women through the years.
Well, it was a shock when everything came out, but I'm afraid I was a very strong Clinton supporter, so I probably didn't react with as much outrage as would have been appropriate. And yes, it was, as we like to say, complicated. You can't come up with a totally good answer. It was abhorrent what he did, but he seemed to reconcile some of us by the kind of president he was.
Another moment in your book that really struck me was when you write about the important role of the ladies' room in your political career as a place to cry.
Yes, in Vermont, it's a citizen legislature, so we don't have our own offices. There's no place to go and be private except maybe out the door. So the ladies' room becomes, when necessary, the crying room, where you can just say what you think and let go. You sort of have to keep your sanity, because you don't want to cry in public. That's the long-standing taboo for women, and crying is a sign of weakness. Now, when men cry, it's almost a sign of strength. But I did cry in the ladies' room, and I walked out feeling better.
I'm wondering if some of these qualities as a leader, as a mother, came from your own mother. And I was wondering if you could tell me about what she was like.
Well, she was a strong woman, and I'm more aware of her strength now when I'm older. My father died when I was 2.5. So in today's vernacular, she was a single parent, and she was bringing up me and my brother. And we came to America not speaking much English, and she made her way. And she also instilled in us certain values. She was very patriotic. In America, anything is possible. That's what she taught the two of us, and that's what we believed in.
And then later, when you became ambassador to Switzerland, your native Switzerland, I'm curious if you could tell us about the importance of reconnecting to your Swiss roots.
Well, it was a wonderful round trip, leaving Switzerland in 1940 at the outbreak of World War II and coming to America. And my mother never dreamt, and I never dreamt, of course, that someday I'd come back as the American ambassador. It was a lovely homecoming. The only flaw in the story is that the big issue facing me in Switzerland as an ambassador was the role of Switzerland during World War II, and the Swiss banks had been a receptacle for money from Jewish Jews who wanted to deposit their funds in a safe place. And after the war, when either the heirs of those who were killed or survivors wanted to get their money back, the banks had a very hard time letting anybody in. So when I was ambassador, part of my job was to retrieve those funds to the rightful owners.
And you faced some anti-Semitism because of that, right?
I don't know if it was because of that. It was subtle anti-Semitism. I mean, nobody came up to me and said, you know, I don't like Jews. It was just that I was identified as a Jew, which in America I never was. You know, I wasn't the Jewish governor. It just wasn't an important question on my resume. But I also had a reunion with some of my Swiss cousins, and I felt I had a purpose as an ambassador. And to retrieve those funds was a wonderful cause. I didn't solve it completely, but we made an important first step. And then I had a moment of identification when the Swiss banks published the accounts that they couldn't identify, and my mother's name was on that. And all of a sudden, I became part of the story. But it turned out when everything was settled, the account turned out to be $150, which I shared with my brother.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Looking back on your amazing life, your career, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Oh, wow. when I graduated from Columbia School of Journalism, my dream job was to work for the Washington Post or the New York Times. So I never got to either one, except I did get to the New York Times when the editorial board wanted to interview me. And I went to the New York Times building, and I was with my state trooper who was in civilian clothes. And we knocked on the door, and their security person came up, looked at my trooper, shook his hand, and said, "Welcome to the Times, Governor." So I did make it to the New York Times after all.
Finally, Governor Kunin, how would you like to be remembered? Perhaps the Kunin legacy?
I don't think in terms of the Kunin legacy, because life changes so much. I guess I'd just like to be known as a good human being, somebody who cared about the state, loved the state, and tried to improve the lives of the people who live in it. I mean, I wasn't a likely candidate. I was a woman. I was Jewish. I didn't have a business background. But somehow the people of Vermont trusted me.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good legacy to me.
Thank you so much.
Madeline May Kunin is a professor at large at the University of Vermont, a former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland, and former governor of Vermont. She spoke to Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna in March. Hey, stay with us. There's more Radio Boston next. I'm Tiziana Deering. Welcome back to this special Labor Day edition of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We've been listening to some of our favorite conversations about finding meaning in work. We've heard from L. Simone Scott, TV personality and a leader in the culinary world. Cellist Lawrence Lesser, who aims to inspire the next generation. You're listening to some of his music now. And right before the break, we heard from former Vermont governor and ambassador Madeline Kunin, who is just finding her true self in her 80s. Next, we want to hear from two Needham brothers who took their passion for T-shirts and turned it into a $100 million clothing empire. John and Bert Jacobs started Boston-based Life is Good 25 years ago this year. And back in 2015, they spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty about their philosophy, the company, and their book, Life is Good, the book. Life and the world can be so cruel and so challenging for so many people. Their message may seem simple, but for John and Bert, the youngest of six siblings, it was their mother's positivity that helped them find meaning in their lives and in their work.
John, our mom, was really the first powerful optimist in our lives and clearly kind of the inspiration for the brand Life is Good. Although Needham's a really beautiful town and kind of an upper middle class town, our home wasn't an upper middle class home. And, you know, there was eight of us sharing a really small place and money was pretty tight. Dad went through some pretty serious depression following a really bad auto accident when we were kids. And my mom kind of kept it all together and got us to focus on what's happening that's right rather than what's going wrong.
Yeah.
And that had a lasting impact.
How did she do that on a day-to-day basis?
I would say the huge thing we look back at that had such great impact was every night at the dinner table, she'd look around at each of us and say, "Tell me something good that happened today." And as simple as that sounds, it changed the energy in the room. Instead of us kind of moaning about a tough assignment or teacher or something like that, we were riffing on something absurd or funny or positive, and that kind of thing creates momentum in a house.
So tell us the story then about how the company was founded, because it wasn't obvious from the start that Life is Good would become what it is.
Yeah. You know, I was 30 years old before we had any success. And JJ, you were what, 26 years old. So we had 5.5 years of failing before we came up with something that was commercially viable. And I think in those 5.5 years, we were selling T-shirts in the street and we were selling door-to-door in college dorms. And we got into this one conversation while we were traveling in the van. It was about how the media inundates us with negative information. Mm-hmm. And we talked about trying to come up with some brand or concept that celebrated life and celebrated what was happening that was right in the world.
Yeah.
The idea really just came from that.
Yeah, and I just add, like, if you go back to that kitchen and mom, like, both Bert and I loved to draw growing up and create and write. And so we started brainstorming right about when I was finishing school, and we drove across country, and that's when we first started talking about starting a business together. And T-shirts were an accessible way to kind of blend art and business. So we jumped into the street scene that Bert talked about, Faneuil Hall, Harvard Square, college dorms. It was pathetic at times, but we had a good time driving around the East Coast, and it did take us 5 years to finally
hit
something.
It's one important thing to point out is that people sometimes look these days and say, life is good now that you have a successful business, et cetera, et cetera. But life was good when we were sleeping in the van. We looked at those days while we were sneaking into the cafeteria to eat and sleeping in the van and all that. We were getting to visit all the college campuses that we couldn't get into. You know?
Yeah.
And we'd had a ball on those campuses. We'd throw the football and the frisbee, hang out by day, learn where we could, get the lay of the land, and then at night we'd sell. So it wasn't a bad life, even in those days.
Well, I'm wondering if you could tell us a story about how you've handled moments where life didn't feel so good. I mean, because the message of optimism is really powerful, but, you know, we've all been through experiences where collectively, we didn't feel all that optimistic. You know, I mean, you write about some of them in the book. I'm thinking about after 9/11.
A day or two after that happened, we were kind of frozen. Like, is it appropriate to send product that says life is good out there? Certainly doesn't feel it right now. And a quiet woman in our warehouse raised her hand at a meeting and said, why don't we do a fundraiser? And we did a simple graphic and stylized American flag and sent it out and told everyone 100% of the proceeds would help the families. And we got a response like five times what we were hoping for. We were hoping to raise about $30,000, and it was like $207,000 in a very short period.
Mm-hmm.
In the darkest times, people are drawn to the light. So when the bombings occurred at the marathon, our offices were actually like a block and a half from the finish line. All of us Bostonians saw EMTs running in to help. We saw runners running an extra mile or two to give blood. And all this love poured in as a result of this.
And then it went beyond the city, and people started sending money and prayers. And when the one fund got going, I mean, it was pretty remarkable.
And we heard again from our community saying, you guys got to do a fundraiser shirt. And it took us a few days to clear our heads and say, yes, we do have to do a fundraiser shirt. And Boston Strong was the prominent message and a great message of resilience that was all over the city.
But that's not the message that you put on the shirt, though.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't feel like our message, and we thought about it a lot. And what we wrote was, nothing is stronger than love. And we posted that on our website, and it became rapidly the best-selling shirt we've ever sold.
Yeah.
So that ended up raising over $500,000 for the one fund, and that was it was very unifying to our team, just like after 9/11, where you're kind of feeling frozen and how do you help? And then, yes, we have a vehicle to help, and the community rallies around it.
Okay, so the hard-nosed journalist in me has one more question for you guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I love your message, and there's so many sort of threads to it that we could discuss. But I'm curious, what if someone listening to this is thinking, this is some hippy-dippy stuff? Like, life is good, but life is also real.
Can I try that part?
Sure.
We feel like optimism is not this soft philosophical viewpoint. It's a pragmatic strategy for living a happy life, for fulfilling goals. You know, we were lucky enough to learn it early on, and we didn't really put all the pieces together, as Bert said, till we were adults. But we've seen it, not just our own story, but like these letters we get. It's real, and it's not floaty, soft, hippie stuff.
Life is not perfect, and life is not easy, but life is good. The most inspirational lessons to us have come from the people that face the worst possible, and that is inspiring. But I think what we're trying to get people to do is just wake up in the morning and start by focusing on what's right with your life rather than what's wrong with your life, because whatever you focus on will grow.
It's right back to Joan's question, right? Tell me
exactly.
Something good
yeah.
that happened to you today.
Exactly.
Right?
John and Bert Jacobs, speaking with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty back in 2015. They co-founded the Life is Good Company and co-wrote Life is Good, the book.
That's our show for this Labor Day. I hope you find meaning in the work that you do. We sure do here at Radio Boston. We are produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And I'm Tisiana Deering. Thanks for listening.